Welcome to everybody. Good afternoon, Prague, and good morning, Washington. And I'm delighted to welcome you for this program this afternoon and I guess it's Wednesday morning, Washington. I'm Jeff Gedman. I'm president of Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm happy to welcome you from our end to a round table that takes place in our brand new state-of-the-art building here in the Czech Republic, here in the capital, Prague. We are in the process of a move. I think this is the first roundtable here in the floor where we have the central newsroom, where we convene an important guest and an important conversation. And this is, if I may say, without insulting our guest, this is a delicious appetizer, because on Friday we'll host former President Havel, who will come and chair our first editorial meeting in the new building. But it's a delicious appetizer, and it's an extremely important one. I think the title is about, in my judgment, is about as clear and as poignant as you can get. Europe's dangerous dependence on Russian gas, it is a prominent theme of the past decade, and I fear it's going to be a central theme in the next as well. And the implications are profound for obvious reasons. I'm going to introduce now, or turn it over to my colleague from our Russian service, Irina Lagugina, who is one of our most distinguished broadcasters. She's a journalist who's worked in print and in electronic media. She's someone who works as a reporter's reporter, if I can put it that way, a journalist, but also is well-versed in public policy. Understands the theoretical and the practical framework in which one talks about these sorts of issues. And it's thanks to her that we have our guest today. She's the one who initiated this program. So, Irina, thank you. Over to you to introduce our guest and to moderate the conversation today.
Thank you, Jeff. Let me just say a few words, biography. Ambassador Bartuska studied journalism at the Faculty of Social Sciences in Charles University and also in Columbia University later, but his main career started after 1989 when he worked as a member of Parliament Committee for the investigation of the causes of the events of 7th of November of Velvet Revolution, and he studied the role of security services there, and that was his main interest. He is currently the Czech Ambassador at Large for Energy Security, and let me give you several quotes of Ambassador Bartuška. He once said, "For me, energy security means freedom." Right. He also confessed that he spent 3 hours with Russian Prime Minister Mr. Putin during a Russian-Ukrainian crisis, and took a special pleasure to tell Russian Prime Minister that in spite of Russia's cuts of oil supplies to Czech Republic in 2008, after the radar deal was signed here, it was the year when Czech Republic imported the biggest volume of oil ever. After this conversation, Russia resumed full supplies of oil.
The technical problems stopped.
Oh, the technical, sorry. Okay. The recent event in this area that we're going to discuss today is the deal between Ukraine and the European Union to modernize its gas pipelines, which immediately triggered Russian reaction. And Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin said a gas plan presented by Ukraine is ill-considered and unprofessional, and immediately threatened to reconsider the principles of Russia-EU energy relationship, whichever it means, and whatever it means. Czech Republic will host the summit, the Energy Security Summit, on May 7th. With this current development, Ambassador Bartuška, what do you expect from this summit? What will make this summit a success?
Well, I think that actually what we really need is a few more crises in deliveries for Europe, because we need to wake up. And the one in January was too short and too small. And I would like to thank publicly Prime Minister Putin and his colleagues for helping us to form a unified European policy, because without his help, we would never have EU27 speaking with one voice in January this year. And sadly, we don't have it at the moment, because as soon as the crises end, we always revert to our usual selfish policies. What you're trying to do at the moment is to come up with a set of principles which might be shared by EU27, even when there is no crisis on the horizon. But I expect it will not come this May or next May, because even though we do share borders and we do share currencies and we do share many other things, in energy matters we do behave like idiots. And we don't use the power we have. I mean, we are the biggest market in the world of 500 million people. We should be calling the shots, not the suppliers. But because we are divided and we act each alone, we lose out this opportunity we have. So that's what we are trying to put on the table, that we do have a huge leverage, or we could have a huge leverage, and we don't use that, which results in you're being blackmailed, or at least threatened by blackmail from many countries, not just Russia. It goes to other energy suppliers, be it Algeria or Middle East countries. So that's all we want to do. It's basically to say frankly that we are in a bind, and if we want to keep on our present, at least, well, if not growth, at least fight it with crisis, we should have much more robust approach and common approach.
We have two distinguished panelists in Washington as well, two experts in the area. Let me introduce them and bring them to our discussion. Ambassador Keith Smith, who served as a U.S. ambassador to Lithuania and has been a consultant to several energy companies, now with the Central for Security and International Studies in Washington in Energy and National Security Program, and Roman Kupchinski, our former colleague, now partner, AZ East Group. Roman used to edit Crime, Corruption, and Terrorism Watch here at RFERL for some 7 years. Let me first ask Ambassador Keith Smith. Ambassador, you, when we last talked, you were very much concerned that your words will trigger a pretty angry reaction from Rosukrenergo again. And I need to say that both Mr. Kupchinski and Ambassador Smith, through their research and investigation, made Rosukrenergo very angry at some point. So, Ambassador, let's start with your comments and questions to Ambassador Bartushka, please.
Well, thanks very much for the buildup. But I think that I've listened to Ambassador Bartushka talk, and I think he knows pretty much what the what we are going to say. I've been following this for quite a while, and I think that the one thing that is continuing to disturb me is the issue he raised, is the lack of a common energy policy within Europe. And there's a clear division between old Europe and new Europe. The countries, the larger countries of Europe, like Germany, France, Italy, and Austria, really are looking at their own commercial interests. And the Russians have been very clever at kind of divide and conquer, and using a lot of the carrots with the large countries on Nord Stream, for instance. One of the reasons why Nord Stream is built, which makes no economic sense, is that it kind of divides a lot of contracts around German industry. And it's the German industry who puts pressure on both of the political groups, major political groups in Germany, to support this, I think, non-economic project. And the same with South Stream and Italy. And you've got countries in the EU who are looking at their short-term economic interests and not paying much attention to what happens east of the German border. I keep hearing from Europeans this crazy phrase that Russia has always been a reliable supplier of energy. Well, maybe it has been east of the west of the Polish border, but it hasn't been east of the Polish border. And now, after the events of this spring, and actually the spring of January 2006, it wasn't even a reliable supplier to Europe then. So what I think is somehow it has to be done is to put together kind of a coalition of countries, particularly starting with the Central European countries that are really in a bind. A lot of them are energy islands, not the Czech Republic, fortunately, but a lot of them are energy islands that are really stuck because of history and geography in monopoly situations with Russia, where Russia is the monopoly supplier of energy. And I think building a coalition of these countries and then bringing in some West European countries who I think would be willing to join would really help the idea of building a coalition in the EU, which could push back a little bit about with the kind of freewheeling policies of the old countries like Germany, Italy, France, who are not interested really in Central European energy security so much. One very sad thing, I think, was the recent 5 billion euro division of energy infrastructure money that the EU is working on. Since the cutoff of January of this year showed that the biggest dangers were in Central and Eastern Europe, and yet most of the money that's going from the EU Commission on that 5 billion euro fund is going to go to Western Europe, the place where it's needed the least, and countries that have the alternative. The question is, what is my question? My question really for Mr. Bartuszka is it possible to build this kind of a coalition within the EU Commission and EU Parliament that will kind of push back with some of the Russian policies and defend the interests of Central and Eastern Europe?
Well, I am not very much liked in many of the Eastern capitals of the EU for what I'm saying, and I'm probably not going to please you either, but I do believe that it must be first the responsibility of the member states to take care of themselves, and only then we can talk about solidarity. What you mentioned about the energy islands in many of the Eastern European countries is perfectly true. But it's also true that it's been now 18 years since the demise of the Soviet Union and 20 years since Eastern Europe got free. And that's plenty of time. The truth is that energy and dependence on Russia for most of Central and Eastern European countries was not a matter of concern for all those years. When this country, Czech Republic, built the pipeline for oil from Germany, which actually allowed us last year to import a record number of oil, this was between 1994 and 1996, our friends in the neighborhood, the Poles, Hungarians, Slovaks, were laughing at us. We have spent $400 million of good money on a pipeline which was needed because we had the Druzhba pipeline and there's plenty of oil in Russia and Russia has always been around. You know, I've heard it all. And we just kept saying that we do have our historical experience, which we share, but we took different lessons out of it. The Czech Republic started to buy Norwegian gas in 1997. After we revamped the whole gas distribution system, and we started to buy, besides Russian, also Norwegian gas. Once again, it was dubbed the expensive Norwegian gas. Well, this January was the only gas coming to the country. It wasn't that expensive anymore. And I do see much more interest in energy infrastructure in Eastern Europe at the moment, but in the same time, quite honestly, if you compare the level of investment in energy in the western part of Europe and eastern part, you will see much more responsibility in the west than in the east. The Brits have built terminals for the LNG, the liquefied natural gas, for 40% of their capacity over the last 10 years. They invested heavily, the same with the French, Germans, and others. In this part of Europe, it did not happen. So that's something that really is our problem. And I would put a question probably differently, or I do ask my politicians slightly differently, which is, we do have money from Europe for infrastructure. It's just that we spent most of this money on transport infrastructure, not on energy. Because whenever you open a new highway anywhere in Eastern Europe, you get all the politicians, living or dead, you know, who want to be pictured there, cutting the ribbon, because that's the moment when you made it to the pages of media. When you open a new interconnector in electricity, I mean, who cares? That's the boring stuff. Most public doesn't care. So if you look at the structural funds of the EU spent in this neighborhood, in the structural funds, the ratio of money spent on transport and energy is 40 to 1. It's 80 billion euros on transport and 2 billion on energy. So unless you have clear interest from the countries themselves and from the public itself, there will be no change, because public wants new airports, new highways, much more than it wants new power lines. They look dirty, ugly, you know, nothing to win. So that is the problem, that actually, even when we love to criticize our Western friends, Western friends in France, Germany, and elsewhere, they actually did their homework in the 1990s and after that. This part of Europe did not. I fully understand Lithuania that it feels scared by the fact that when it closes down Ignalina, the nuclear power plant, it will be almost totally dependent on Russian electricity. At the same time, hello, you've been independent since 1991, and you have agreed to close down Ignalina in late 1990s. So some homework probably wasn't done. And the same can be applied to other countries. It can be applied to my country as well. I mean, we could have done much more than we did. I'm glad that we at least built some pipelines, and we contracted some gas from Norway, but there is still plenty of work to do on our part as well. The truth is that France and Germany and Britain are much more secure than this part of Europe, which is also why they don't really share our fear of Russia, because they have nothing to fear. If Russia is one of five major suppliers for you and all of them are below 20%, why should you care? If Vladimir Vladimirovich stops delivering gas, you get it from elsewhere. But if you buy 100% of your gas from Russia, it's a different story.
Let's bring in Roman Kupchinski to our discussion. Roman, please, your comments and your questions.
Thank you, Irina. In a time of very rapidly changing loyalties, I'm glad that I'm back at my old alma mater, RFERL, for a few hours before I run back to somewhere else. Last week, I began working on thinking about this meeting today. And 2 days ago, I had to change everything because of the agreement that was signed in Brussels on March 23rd between the European Union and Ukraine. The immediate reaction, the violent reaction of Vladimir Putin, the Russian delegation walking out of the conference hall that same day before the conference was ended, the comments by Putin that we will review our relations with the EU and possibly change contracts, raise the price of gas, or change the price of gas arbitrarily, unilaterally, for me were very shocking and not really understandable immediately. Why? What happened? Well, what happened was, I think the major point of it is, that the whole structure of gas delivery, of gas transit from Russia to the EU can change, which will have dramatic consequences for the whole energy structure and the whole concept of the Russian Federation and of Gazprom towards where it is going. The EU-Ukrainian agreement stated that the EU would buy its gas at the Russian-Ukrainian border, and that the EU would pay transit costs to Ukraine. Up to now, the whole transit facility was from Russia to the German border, to the Slovak border, to the countries that had signed the contracts. What in fact happens now, if the EU goes along with this and doesn't renege in the near future, is that the Ukrainian gas transport system will be integrated into the European gas transit system. Now, this is a colossal meaning in terms of the whole complex of issues dealing with transit. Don't forget that the largest transit of gas to the EU comes through Ukraine. A second point in the EU-Ukraine agreement was to possibly expand the Ukrainian main trunk pipeline to have an extra 60 billion, almost 60 billion cubic meters more of put-through capacity. Putin, he reacted by saying, well, how do you know we'll give you that gas? How do you know if we're able to fill that? What Putin was really saying was that if this happens, Nord Stream and South Stream will not be needed. And this is something that Putin and Gazprom have put their major bets on over the last few years. This is one of the major reasons for the January 2008 boycott of Europe, not because Ukraine owed Russia money for gas. That's not true. Ukraine paid by 31 December 2008. It paid off all its debts. And nonetheless, they were blockaded. So, you know, the Russian arguments fall to the wayside. But this, if Nord Stream and South Stream are not viable, commercially they're not viable. It would cost $10 billion to renovate the Ukrainian pipeline, expand its throughput capacity by $60 billion, and Nord Stream and South Stream become commercially unfeasible, this would open the way for Nabucco to gain more supporters from those European countries that initially, thus far, have gone along with the South Stream project. This is, I think, the essence of what is the reaction we're seeing today in Moscow. And just to quote Walter Boltz, the vice chairman of the European Regulators Group for Electricity and Gas, in an interview with the Kommersant Daily today, he stated, "In reality, there are no reasons why Russia should ensure transit of gas and why we shouldn't pay for transit. We buy gas at the Ukrainian-Russian border and worry about its delivery ourselves. I believe there is no alternative." And that's very important. My question is, will the EU stick to this? Will Putin abandon the present gas pricing policy of linking it to gas to oil products and choose an arbitrary price that he would pull out of the air, like he pulled out of the air the $250 per 1,000 cubic meters for Ukraine? It was a totally arbitrary figure. There was no commercial reason for this. It was totally arbitrary. So I believe this is one of the biggest questions that I have to you. Will the EU stick to this, or will it slowly be torn apart, Germany going its own direction, the French in another? The only Europeans who have, the only European company which has come out against the EU-Ukraine agreement is Italy so far, for many other reasons.
Well, that's a good question. Thank you very much for this. I think I know something about the situation. Somewhere in the beginnings of all this is a non-paper which I wrote actually in December 2006. About just when I get in my position, and I said that the situation, the state of the transit pipelines is such that we have to worry. Because I compared how much money we invested in the renewal of our pipelines for oil, for gas, and with the fact that nothing was done east of our border. And from that actually started some sort of study of the state of the pipeline network of Russia. I had a beautiful spat in that time with Alexander Medvedev, the deputy head of Gazprom, who basically claimed that pipelines are in perfect order in Russia and nothing is going to, there's no need for any investment. And last year when we met again, we meet regularly, he was praising the company for spending half of its investment budget on renewal of the pipelines. So I thank him very much for investing money in something that's not needed. And, actually, Russians started to renew the pipelines. In Ukraine, the situation is much more complicated for one reason. Naftogaz is, and I say this with all respect to people who actually work there, and I have quite a few friends there, Naftogaz is a totally unknown to the outside world black box company, which has everything in it. And since 2007, EU keeps saying, if you want to renew and repair the gas transit pipelines, you have to take out the Ukrtransgaz, the company which runs the pipelines, and take it out of Naftogaz. Because then you can actually have some sort of control of the investments. You can have a look at the money being spent and how is it being spent. And trust me, this is not a proposal which is being loved by many in Ukraine. I hope I will not insult anyone's feelings, but Naftogaz is milked by many in Ukraine. And the fact that it's basically bankrupt and has been bankrupt for quite some time is, for me, it's a major wonder. know, how can you actually be bankrupt when you ram 80% of Russians' gas exports to Europe, and the oil transits to Hungary, Czech Republic, and Slovakia? I mean, how can you make such a wonder of losing billions of dollars, and you should be the most profitable company in Ukraine? And the reason is very simple. There are plenty of people who make huge amounts of money out of Naftogaz, and those are mostly in Ukraine themselves. And, you know, the transparency issue, as it's being usually called, I put it in very much more blunted terms. I keep telling my Ukrainian friends that they steal too much too fast, and they are stealing their country away. With this tempo, Ukraine will lose Crimea and maybe its own independence. And I think that's really what's at play at the moment, what's at stake. Because you see a much stronger Russia, much more determined Russia, which really wants something and knows what it wants. And you have Ukraine on the other side, which is not consistent, which has a president fighting the prime minister. I mean, you know it better than I do, I guess, by your name. And that's just frustrating, all our efforts. So the fact that Ukraine agreed to something that I actually agreed to before, which is taking the Ukrtrans gas out of Naftogaz, is a great step. We want to see it fulfilled, because only then money can actually come to Ukraine for investment. We've heard on Monday a very clear statement from the president of the European Investment Bank, Mr. Maystadt, as well as the vice president of EBRD, Mr. Freeman, that without transparency and basic accounting rules, no one is going to pour billions of euros into Ukraine, because those money would just vanish. And we will see. Europe is prepared, and I clearly, you know, even though the government in Czech Republic fell last night, you know, we will still be running the show till late June. And I can promise you that we will stick to what we're doing, and we have no chance of policy. No change of tack. It will depend very much on what the Ukrainians will want to do. And I was very pleased that we saw both Mrs. Tymoshenko and Mr. Yushchenko in the same place in the same time without actually arguing with each other loudly. And it was a very nice sight. I would love to see it more often, and not just in Brussels and for 10 or 15 minutes. And I do sincerely hope that Ukrainians themselves and Ukrainian elite will understand what is at stake. It's the survival of their country. The reaction from Moscow is so strong because this is precisely what is at stake. Yes. And I couldn't put it more bluntly. And I know that I should be diplomat because my position is such, but I came from security field and I'm used to speak relatively bluntly. I think this is what is at stake, and that's why we are trying so much to keep Ukraine on track. But they have to want it themselves.